This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. By now, you've probably seen the countless videos and still images of police violence against protesters in towns and cities across the country. Among the most senseless assaults was the case of 75-year-old Martin Gugino.
You have an officer shoving an elderly protester entirely unprovoked, which results in a 75-year-old man hitting the ground with blood pooling from his head onto the concrete, as you see there.
But according to President Trump, the whole thing was an elaborate ruse, an act of terrorism even.
Quoting his tweet, "Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur."
Yes, once again, inviting Americans to disbelieve what we've all seen with our own eyes. But this latest exercise in presidential gaslighting fit right snug with an all-encompassing Antifa conspiracy theory that has temporarily replaced Obamagate and Deep State as the go-to boogeyman in right-wing media. Rudy Giuliani on Sebastian Gorka's radio show.
It will help a lot in being able to tie together some of the loose ends that could tell you then how well organized this is. It could answer the Soros question too. If you could get into their books, how much money does he donate and how closely associated is he with it?
As Antifa has been increasingly portrayed by the right as Antichrist, NBC News reporter Brandi Zadrozny has traced the path from careless web chatter to the president's Twitter to an actual conspiracy, a disinformation campaign centered in right-wing media. Brandi, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
First, let's work on definitions. What is Antifa? What isn't it?
So Antifa is a loose collection of hundreds, maybe a couple of thousand radical groups and people, generally the far left, who share an ideology and tactics. The way that I best describe it is if you see a Nazi, punch a Nazi, you don't go call the cops and say there's a Nazi. And it's rooted in the idea that, you know, the Nazi Party would have never come to power in Germany if people had literally fought them in the streets. The modern movement came to Europe in the 60s and then to the US in the 70s and 80s with Antifa people fighting skinheads at punk rock shows. I think the idea behind the anti-fascist ideology is that fascism and the far right is inherently violent. It violates and it hurts marginalized people, people of color. They believe that it is inherently right to fight, sometimes violently, a movement and the far right that is violent itself.
The president is treating Antifa as his latest boogeyman, but the foundation for the conspiracy theory was laid years ago. Was there a particular moment when fears about Antifa, you know, went prime time?
I think when they popped back on the scene happened to be at Donald Trump's inauguration. People who were labeled Antifa were seen wreaking havoc in the streets. There was a big moment where someone who was labeled as Antifa punched Richard Spencer, who coined the alt-right. And then what happened in 2019 was the punching of Andy Ngo.
This guy is a right-wing provocateur who had himself been going after Antifa members, identifying them, doxing them on his blog.
Right. Andy is a self-described journalist, but definitely a conservative provocateur. He trolls the left endlessly. He used to go and film these protests. And, He's been charged with selectively editing what he shows. He's also pushed several hoaxes claiming that mass murders were perpetuated by Antifa, which later turned out to be false. And he's also been outed as being pretty chummy with the white nationalists that he says that he covers. At one event in 2019, he was punched and several milkshakes were thrown on him. And he claimed that, with the help of police, claimed that there was cement in the milkshakes. That turned out also later to be false. But the event itself was all filmed, and he used it to propel himself into the national conversation. Jake Tapper came out in defense of Ngo. And what that did was solidify this idea of, I'm objective, this is wrong too, the left does it too.
Tapper, who, you know, whose heart was in the right place, condemning violence, has been accused of trading in false equivalency.
Yeah, you can't equate Antifa with the far right. What's hard about these online spaces is, you know, for reporters who've reported on extremism, you know, relentlessly for the last few years, we sort of know the game. And so we know who these characters are. So then when someone like Andy Ngo pops up in a video that looks like he's been beaten up, we can say, okay, well, but there's probably more to this story. But the images itself are violent. So that's the sort of problem with Antifa too, is that things like this can sort of throw the narrative askew and give people like President Trump and crazy far-right blogs like Gateway Pundit, it gives them ammunition and it lets them sort of create this martyr story for their movement as the persecuted, the censored right, when that's just not really the case either.
And so they did. When protests erupted after George Floyd's death, the right-wing media and politicians used images of looting and arson in Minneapolis is proof of Antifa insurrectionism. Now, we're used to seeing this kind of rhetoric flourish on social media and the right-wing media like Fox. But what made your recent piece so fascinating was watching the conspiracy theory playing out IRL. Tell me about Klamath Falls, Oregon.
Klamath Falls is a sleepy little town in Oregon, you know, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. 9 out of 10 residents are white. It is a gun-loving, God-loving, you know, town. And last Sunday, on a closed private Facebook group, where these Facebook groups are everywhere, it's especially with the depletion of local news, we've really seen these pop up. And it's like, you know, lost wallets, lost keys. There's a sale at the local whatever. But it's also a rumor mill. So what we saw is on Sunday, a girl just out of high school posted, I don't mean to alarm anybody, but I'm hearing something from local law enforcement that there are 2 buses headed this way from Portland, full of Antifa, loaded with bricks. They're going to come to Klamath Falls, destroy it, murder police officers, and they're going to go into all the white neighborhoods and mess them up. And then someone else posted a notice from a local commander of the Oregon Air National Guard. And it was a screenshot of a DM that he had allegedly sent his team. And it said, stay away from downtown. We have intel. There's going to be busloads of Antifa coming tonight. And offline, people started the scavenger hunt for these buses of Antifa. You know, they went to the Walmart. They went to the TJ Maxx. Someone said, I saw a U-Haul parked in front of the House of Shoes. You know, someone posted that they had seen a person all in black at Albertsons and that was Antifa. And they took this threat so seriously that by, you know, 8 o'clock that evening, hundreds of them lined the street.
You did not attend the protest, but it was live streamed on Facebook by one of the armed men in attendance. You did speak with some of the local protesters. So paint the scene for us.
The Black Lives Matter protest started with a couple of people out with some signs. And by nighttime, maybe 100, maybe 150 people were on the side of the street. They were saying the names of people of color who've been killed in police custody. What was notable about it, too, was that even, you know, this is a town where 9 out of 10 people were white, but during the protest, it was white, black, Latino people, members of the Native American Klamath tribes, and LGBTQ communities. It was really, really a diverse coalition of peaceful people. It was lovely. It's what's been happening all over small towns. Even sunset towns have had people come and say, no, this is an important movement, and they've been protesting. Now, on the south side of the street, maybe 200, mostly white neighbors had come, and they were leaning against storefronts. They were wearing military fatigues, bulletproof vests. They had blue bands tied around their arms, and they were carrying, you know, flags, American flags, Trump flags, but also lots of weapons. So we saw baseball bats, hammers, an axe, and then lots of guns. I talked to one resident, his name's Frederick Brigham, and he is one of the town's only black people. And he came through and he said it felt like walking through an enemy war camp. And on that side of the street throughout the night, there was lots of chanting to the Black Lives Matter protesters, a lot of making fun of them, a lot of USA, USA, and a lot of go home, which was particularly striking because these people were from there. This is their home.
So what happened when the buses arrived and the Antifa marauders stepped down and started throwing punches?
The buses never came. They never arrived. The peaceful protest went on. And then a bunch of armed people shuffled home. The next day, people logged back onto Facebook to report what they had seen. And a surprising number of people reported that they had run Antifa off, even though there was no Antifa to be seen.
So they actually saw the monsters under the bed.
I don't know. If Antifa never came, if they have to say that to themselves, then what they did was stand across the street and intimidate a bunch of mostly young, mostly people of color, and really prove the whole reason that those protesters would have been out there in the first place. So I think instead of do that, because that's real hard, what's easier to say was that, okay, well, we were just protecting our town if Antifa did come. And, you know, if Antifa ever does come, well, then we'll be here.
Now, this is Klamath Falls. Various versions of this story played out elsewhere. Can you give me some examples?
Sure. In Forks, Washington, there was this situation where locals felled trees with chainsaws to block this road because they feared that a multiracial family inside was actually Antifa people. And they had to be saved by local high schoolers. This is happening in South Bend, Indiana. It's happening in Idaho. It's happening in Florida. It's literally happening in every single state. And we can almost always find an original group that was operating locally on Facebook that helped spread this rumor.
The fact that Antifa never arrived in Klamath Falls, the fact that these buses never existed to begin with, does no harm to the political right. The president's campaign for re-election greets you on its website immediately with a prompt that says, "Stand with President Trump against Antifa." There's a significant chunk of the electorate that's prepared to believe it and act accordingly. We have been reporting various versions of this story for 4 years. If it's going to be simply disbelieved by the audience, why do we bother?
Wow. I, for a long time, have stopped thinking that I can really change anyone's mind that's fully entrenched. I want to reach the fence sitters. I hope that when someone sees this that doesn't know what to think, that it'll be a little drop in the bucket for truth. And then if I can't do that, I think it's just important to document what's happening. So in 10 years, when we look back and realize that this was all a political ploy, we can know what happened.
Brandy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Brandy Zadrozny is a reporter with NBC News. You can read more of her reporting on NBCNews.com.
Did you think that your feet had been bound by what gravity brings to the ground? Did you feel you were tricked by the future you picked? Well, come on down.
That That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio, with more help from Eleanor Nash. Come on down. We're coming down to the ground. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. Come down to the ground. We hear the birds.